I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You're on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I mean to plant a flag in the sand for conscious, willful people to gather, organize, empathize, and capsize the established order of things. Our opposition? Team Machine, Team Capitalism, Team Algorithm, Team No Team, I'm my own team. Being human is a team sport, so thanks for playing. Playing for Team Human today, the founders of Extinction Rebellion, Gail Bradbrook and Claire Farrell.
We want life to live, and I think there's that part of ourselves when that's in the driving seat, we'll solve this.
It's entirely about being a human being and what you love and what you care about.
Gail and Claire will be showing us how the critical mass required to foment global change may be much closer than we think. It's time to get people upset. Provoke the cultural immune response we need to prevent our own extinction. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. I'll be in Los Angeles next week at LA Review of Books Festival on Sunday, April 14th, and for free at New House in Hollywood on Monday, April 15th. I'm also doing a special open classroom at the 92nd Street Y in New York on May 21st. More info about these events and more at teamhuman.fm. You can find our archive of broadcasts and written versions of my monologues at Medium. And as always, you can support this show by becoming a subscriber, getting books and t-shirts and access to our SpeakPipe and special content. I gave a talk at Winter Music Conference a couple of weeks ago. It's a group of old ravers and music designers and club organizers. And somehow, when I was among them, it felt like I'd come full circle, saying stuff I hadn't even said since the Disinfocon back in 1999. That was another crazy conference with speakers like Grant Morrison and Robert Anton Wilson and Marilyn Manson. I got to do the opening keynote, and I remember I begged the counterculture simply to accept victory. We won, I remember I tried to explain. And now the overculture is trying to learn from us, to be like us. We shouldn't hoard our cool, but share it. In other words, don't reject them or George Bush or any of these yuppies for who they were, but welcome them for who they want to be now that they see that we were right. And I realize times are hard. Economic equality is high. Racism is on the rise. Climate crisis is in progress. And all of these issues need to be addressed urgently. But I'm also growing increasingly concerned about the rigidity of the progressive left in its understanding of positive social change. There's almost a refusal to accept victory. So, for instance, earlier this year, when a brand like Nike decides to make ads in favor of Colin Kaepernick, I get it. We want to reject them. It's blatant pandering to Black Lives Matter, right? But it's also an indication that a big company, a big, big corporation wants to show it's on a particular side of a conflict. Or when Pepsi and Kendall Jenner do a zillion-dollar advertisement paying homage to some sort of Black Lives Matter rally. I know, yes, it's inane. It reduces social justice activism to some sort of fashion statement. But it's also a sign that Pepsi wants to get on board whatever this thing is as best they can understand it. It may have been a watered-down, issueless protest they were depicting, but no one could miss that they were trying to side with millennial angst and social justice warriorship in general. Just as many millennials do. You know, as social satire, in some ways it reveals a whole lot about activism as cultural fashion. But that's not the point here, or maybe that's the real reason so many activists are so triggered by this. We know, at least in part, that we too are suckered by the sexy fun of all this, and sometimes have trouble articulating what it is exactly about the system that we want to change. But no matter how symbolic or watered down or branded these efforts, what the corporations are trying to do is get on the right side of history. Think of it cynically, and it makes perfect sense. These giant corporations are picking sides in the culture wars. It's not short-lived pandering. They can't afford that. Unlike politicians, who can target different sides of themselves to different constituencies or simply appeal to a local base, corporations necessarily communicate to everyone at once. Super Bowl advertising is one size fits all. So when a corporation decides to back Colin Kaepernick, BLM, economic equality, or climate remediation, they're making a bet that these sides are the ones that are going to win. It's not simply employees or shareholders pushing management to do the right thing, even though that looks more earnest. No, it's future forecasters telling the branding department where things are headed. It's companies realizing that their own futures better be tied to the side that's going to win. Cynical, maybe, but they're not people. They're corporations. They don't have feelings. They just have power. Instead of rejecting such efforts, we should welcome them. Think of them as dinosaurs that can be trained. Likewise, I've been just as disturbed by many progressives' take-no-prisoners approach to social justice. Bernie Sanders, perhaps the most responsible person for bringing the Democratic Party home from its neoliberal vacation, he became the object of a lot of ridicule for having used the word niggardly in a speech 30 years ago. Now, this word, I won't use it again, I promise, for those who don't know, it has nothing to do with anyone's race. It means stingy. The word was on my SATs in 1979. And yet, now that we've moved into an era of triggers, we can't use the word because it sounds like a racial slur. I get that. By the same token, we shouldn't be talking about Burger King Whoppers because that name contains a racial slur also. But that's not the point. The problem is that the more we attack people for whatever they did before they were woke, the less progress we're going to make. Why agree that we should move beyond a certain behavior or attitude if doing so simply makes us vulnerable to attack? So how can a DC politician, for example, push for the Washington Redskins to change their name when she knows there's footage somewhere of her rooting for the team or wearing a jersey with a Native American on it? Even though the politician may agree with the need for a change, she'll have to resist or at least slow the wheels of progress, lest she get caught under the cart herself. Intolerance and shaming is not the way to win allies. Progressives are mad, hurt, and traumatized. But we've got to dismantle this circular firing squad and begin to welcome positive change rather than punish those who are trying to get woke.
I'm Arthur Brock, and I'm on Team Human.
I'm Inanya Roy, and I'm on Team Human.
My name's Aaron Barnes, and I'm on Team Human.
I'm Aaron Gill, and I'm on Team Human.
We're Team Human, coming to you, alive, from the Basement Media Squad, home to the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at CUNY Queens College. There's an emotional component to waking up to our social, political, economic, and climate predicaments. And a mix of anger, shock, exhilaration, fear. Yet, properly integrated, they can all serve us as we attempt to muster the collective fortitude to confront these interconnected challenges. I'm honored to have two guests today who are practicing state-of-the-art activism that acknowledges and leverages these various emotional components. They've begun a movement centered in London but spreading fast around the world called Extinction Rebellion. They shut down bridges in London last year and are planning to shut down the whole city of London next week until government agrees to engage with them about this global emergency. I'm joined by molecular biophysics PhD and economic justice campaigner Gail Bradbrook and body politic fashion designer turned hunger strike activist Claire Farrell, who took an hour off their preparations to share what's happening with Team Human. Hello. Oh my gosh. So there's so much to talk about. So something just happened yesterday. Some semi-naked person running through Parliament or something we heard about all the way here in the States. Was that a friend of yours?
It was 12 people. It was 12 Extinction Rebellion people. They all got arrested. Some of them glued themselves. There was a couple dressed as elephants.
An elephant. This is what's going wrong. We need to stop carbon emissions now. Not yesterday, not in 2 years' time. Now, extinction. Extinction.
We have this newspaper called The Sun, and they've always got the cheesiest headlines, and they had things like abreast of the issues and stuff like that. But yeah, it was in all the main papers. We'd been told by The Guardian some time ago by one of the journalists that if we had 50 people sent to jail, we'd get a front cover. Well, it turns out 12 people getting naked in Parliament does the job. So that's a bit better.
That's great. I mean, part of what I love about Extinction Rebellion, which I guess we'll explain more fully as we go, is the almost mathematical precision of, okay, if we have, you know, this many people at a remote high leverage point, it can create this much change. I mean, one of the most intriguing parts of some of your I guess the background information on Extinction Rebellion, which is a UK-based but now global climate change effort, is the sort of, well, the research that you did as a PhD of civil disobedience, that if a certain percentage of people protest or come out, it leads to social change.
So that's Erica Chenoweth's data. She's an American researcher. She's based in the American military, I understand, and I think her aim was to disprove that non-violent civil disobedience was effective, but she ended up proving it was the best way to go about things. It's more stable. And as part of researching, I think, of order 330-odd moments of revolution or significant social change, she found that this magic number of up to 3.4% of the population need to be in active participation.
And that's all it takes?
Yeah, I mean, it's no small feat. I mean, well, actually, the American Civil Rights Movement at its height was 1% of the population.
Huh.
So it can be less. But the point is, you do have to have active participation. And so in the UK, we think it's around 2 million people. It really certainly answers this question that goes, along the lines of what about the Daily Mail readers, which may not mean much to American audiences, but it's the kind of newspaper where you go if you want to hear quite racist or, you know, right-wing kind of...
Right, like our New York Post or something, yeah. It's not a Murdoch publication, is it?
There are five billionaires who own most of the press in the UK. Mm. The Daily Mail is a different guy, but it's of the same breed.
So it'd be great to get, I guess, both your stories and kind of how you found each other. I mean, I'm guessing as far as Extinction Rebellion itself, that Gail, you were working with Rising Up before then. So I guess your history with social change and climate activism predates this current movement, yeah?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think I started being an activist when I was 9, to be honest. So it depends how far you want to go back. I joined the Green Party when I was 14. I helped get a Hunt Sabotage group off the ground when I was a teenager. I've been involved in the transition movement and economic literacy, and I'd set something up called Compassionate Revolution. So I think the way I often say it is I failed many times in the past to do anything spectacular, but I did try.
And then how did the extinction part, how did Extinction Rebellion get conceived?
I mean, so the main bit of the story from my perspective was having tried to start a mass tax disobedience. I used to do some work with the Tax Justice Network. So, the mass tax disobedience didn't work. And so I actually went to, as a pagan, prayed very deeply with some medicine to ask for what I needed, which was for a team of people to work with and for what I actually called the Codes for Social Change. And I can get into more details about that. But within a month of that prayer, this whole journey started. And it literally, one moment of it involved having a 4-hour meeting with Roger Hallam, where he said to me at the end of it, I've just given you the Codes for Social Change, which was literally the words of this prayer. So it's very mysterious, some of it from my perspective. But very practically speaking, what happened after that was that Roger and I were talking to various groups and trying to get a group together that would have a strategy. I mean, that had been my longing for a long time was, look, surely we can think strategically about how we change things. Roger had been doing a lot of research into how things change and had a lot of texts and literature and research that I needed to read up on, and we got some training. So we then tested some tactics out for a couple of years, and that's... Claire can say when she came on board in that phase of testing. And then it was April in my house in Stroud last year when we made this decision that we were ready to try and start a rebellion. And there were 15 of us in a cafe in Bristol in the May planning this thing. So it does feel like a dream come true. It's quite amazing. I have to pinch myself at times.
And Claire, what was the path that got you to that same sort of point of intersection?
Well, my background had been in like creative activism and in a much less pointed way. And then in trying to work within my industry, which was fashion, trying to educate and to run small businesses that addressed all of the issues of my sort of sector, because I thought that it needed completely overhauling. And when I left university, I think I thought that I was going to like just totally fix the fashion industry because someone had to do it and no one was trying. And at some point several years ago, I think I just felt really dejected and like nobody was willing to do anything of the scale of the magnitude what was necessary. And so when I saw the news about Roger Hallam on hunger strike at King's College over divestment, part of a campaign that he did, it stood out to me as somebody doing something which felt like an appropriate action to take. And then it won, which was also something that I found out later, which was very appealing, of course. So I went and like met him at a meeting, thinking everyone's going to be interested in this. It's you know, such a sort of vital response to something that's very urgent. And there was only about 6 people there. And I watched some videos of some had Gail in it doing civil disobedience. And we spoke about the sort of ideas behind Rising Up, and I got involved in doing roadblocks. And then we did roadblocks every 2 weeks for several months, which was quite exhausting when you're not used to going and regularly doing things like that. And then within a year, I was also on hunger strike. So I sort of just threw myself at it, really. And it felt like something that made me, it was quite cathartic. It made me feel much better about things, which I sort of feel maybe I'd sort of partly already gone through a process of like giving up because I felt like nobody was going to do it.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, so from the fashion perspective originally, were you thinking in terms of, you know, the problems with fashion about, you know, how it makes young women feel about their bodies and the competition for social status? Or were you looking at, you know, global supply chain of these, you know, awful chemicals or the slave labor going into manufacturing? I mean, what was sort of the, or was it everything?
Well, I did chemistry A level and I was always really interested in science. So for me, it came from like an environmental science place. And like, really, it began with the hole in the ozone layer. So when I was at school and we knew that like the science around understanding how we break down ozone with CFCs was like understood in the 1970s. And then I was learning about it at school and it was still in consumer products and they were still just only talking about phasing it out whilst we were making a big hole in the sky and everyone was saying it was like going to be catastrophic. I thought, you know, what's really going on here is like everybody ignoring science, which understands what we're doing to the environment, and people can't act on it. And really, that's still the same question that unfortunately I ask myself now, but that's led me in quite a scientific basis for the start of my journey, definitely. So I was always kind of interested in sustainability from that perspective. And then as I went down the road, I got more interested in social issues and more interested in people's sort of how people are affected individually by the fashion industry as well. So the breadth of all the issues sort of came gradually after that. And so I've been working in that space for quite a long time now. So I see the sort of the way that everything's interconnected more. But at the beginning, it felt like, for me, it was all about pollution and science, mostly.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting for both of your paths, and this is not to pick on others, but there are many people who've had similar origin stories, yet gone in very, in less constructive directions. So I know many a young person who, you know, goes down to South America and has a full-on ayahuasca experience and come back, you know, thinking that they're, you know, channeling the voice of Quetzalcoatl telling us to take care of our planet, you know, and you know, maybe write great books and do talks and then, you know, do more ayahuasca and get laid and start a cult and yay. Or people in fashion, you know, they come, they see, oh, look, there's supply chain problems, there's chemical problems, there's this, and then become part of, you know, the you know, Nike or you know, H&M marketing campaign to connect with concerned millennials, you know, and you know, you have a nice picture of the planet on your polyester briefcase or something, you know, that how do you prevent, I mean, and almost this is like asking someone a question about Tibetan Book of the Dead, but how do you prevent being distracted by going down one of those roads, which is so much easier, but yields so much more immediate positive feedback? Instead, you ended up kind of pushing through towards that scarier, more potentially cynical place.
It's a really good question. I mean, I was part of the CSR machinery for a while, by the way, so we've all been there probably. Mm-hmm. I think we live in such a deeply narcissistic, individualistic culture that all of us are going to be dragged into it. And I think there's a real team issue here about who do you hang out with, who keeps reminding you of reality. And it's that inner voice that's speaking to you, saying, fuck, this is not getting sorted, is it? You know, you see the cars with one person in jamming up the roads, you see the fracking starting, and you've got that deep dis-ease, if you like, and are you going to listen to that? I think the difference is, from my perspective, has been that ongoing seeking of information about how does it work. I mean, I'm fascinated by everything, really. Mm. Like, where's the psychology? You know, I'm still always learning. I'm reading, listening about terror management theory at the minute, having read Catherine Ingham's essay. You know, what is it that keeps people in denial? Why do parents especially not want to think about this stuff when they've got the kids they're going to face this, you know? So, and there's a lot of information out there, and it's sort of how you come to understand that something's possible, and then how you constellate a team of people that are willing to put in the time and effort to work together. And it does take time, doesn't it, to trust each other, to get clear on what the pathway is and to try things out. And maybe it's also a little bit, from my perspective, fueled originally by that narcissism that kind of goes, well, it's probably not going to work, Gail, but at least I'll look like I tried. Mm. You know, like, so I don't think I'm not anything special in that way. But there's something here, Doug, I think, or Douglas. Do you prefer Doug or Douglas?
Well, and there's time, Douglas. It feels less like a golfer, yeah.
I'm going to call you Doug just to be a knock.
That's fine.
I think it's, for me, it's really interesting, that herding effect, isn't it? That people have been ready for something. And so, in the words of Mickey Kashtan, who's been supporting us to think about decentralization, she studied things like the Occupy movement. She said that you don't create a social movement, you invite it into being, because it's already there. It already wants to exist. And I think so many people have said, I just have been waiting for this for so long.
Right. I mean, well, that's what Chairman Mao said, you know? He did know how to organize on a certain level, even if his politics was bad. But right, that you can't foment a revolution. You can just facilitate one that wants to happen. And I suppose the same with this, although there's got to be a reason why you've been able so far to catalyze this when, I mean, and I know over the last 20 years, we've been trying and watching so many, I mean, from gosh, my first Earth Day, you know, to now, you know, Occupy gave me some hope, but it was a little bit, you know, it was a baby step in some ways, but it was the first, you know, first half of the first inning of a much longer, much longer game, you know, and you obviously took some lessons from that, but do you think it was just the readiness, or do you think that you've set the table in a slightly different way to allow things to happen?
I think there's been a number of factors, some that were designed and some that were good luck. So some you might put down to intuition. So here's what I think the factors are. One is that we'd understood something about building social movements from people like the INE Institute, who give training and momentum-driven organising. Quite frankly, there's lots that we haven't done that well, and let's stay humble here. This thing could collapse into a heap by the end of the year, you know, so we're just doing our best. So there's some real graft was put in by people. So every time somebody would like the Facebook page, one of the first things that Claire did was to help us to decide on the name, by the way. Mm. It was a 25-step process, and we still nearly fell out over it. you know, you've got to get some of that right, haven't you? So anyway, every time somebody liked the Facebook page, then somebody would reach out to them and say, do you want to talk in your local community? And somebody would go and do a talk to them. And so that, you know, we've must have delivered about 200 talks in just in the UK. So that's some sheer bloody effort gone into that, right? And then obviously in the summer, you had the colliding of the IPCC report, the UN, what the UN was saying about climate change. You had things like the Hot House Earth paper, the writings of Davis Wallace Wells, you know, so there was a number of kind of, and then also just the weather, you know, and obviously people in other countries have been on the front line of climate nightmares for many years, but for more Western countries to be feeling the heat quite literally. So there was that factor. Another factor was the innovation that Roger came up with, that we should tell the truth and ask people to act accordingly, which, when it turns out, when you look into that more deeply, is two parts of a three-part emergency mode messaging. So That's, you can look that up online by Jay Morton, Emergency Mode Messaging. But the idea is that the Green Movement has made a fundamental error and was possibly deliberately dragged into this error, that you're not allowed to tell people things that frighten them because you've got to keep them hopeful. You've got to say, well, it's pretty bad, but you could do this.
Right.
You know,
that's the sales, sort of sales theory of social change.
Yeah. Well, and you only have to look at anti-tobacco campaigns or campaigns around, you know, speeding or whatever. They use fear, but they use a three-part process. They say, look, this really, really terrible thing could happen. It's possible for it not to happen if you do this thing. So that's holding the vision that change is possible. We're now asking you to act according to this information. That's the three bits of emergency mode messaging. It fits very well with psychology, and that people step up in emergencies and people can have a really good time in emergency and really bond in their communities and so on. So it's emergencies. I mean, I think the Chinese for the word emergency is some combination of the word danger and opportunity.
Right.
I think the other piece that's been really significant, again, and I think to an extent by instinct, is the piece around grief and trauma. Mm-hmm. That Extinction Rebellion, we understood relatively early on. I was going through it in August when I was doing a rewrite of the science of the talk and how we were going to present the talk. And I was just breaking down, really. I was having a grieving process, and it just became clear to me that that's something that I hadn't faced, even though, like Claire, you know, I'd been arrested for myself at a fracking site with my arm in an arm tube and an incinerator site and all the rest of it. I'd got my clothes off on the steps of a parliament building and all the rest of it. So tried all this stuff and yet somehow hadn't faced up to how I feel about this thing. And there's something where we've, you know, it's not for everybody, but where we've said to people, this, when you face it, feels awful. It feels awful. And if you are willing to face that, and it's really important to do it with other people, or you think you're going a bit bonkers, then you will have something of a breakdown. And through the process of grief and trauma, we talk about, you know, grief is a price you pay for love. And when you feel love, you feel courage. And there's and so you can come out the other side of this thing. I would say it actually comes in cycles.
Yeah. And I'll say, I mean, I spent not last night, the night before last night, I spent, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours reading all the background on your stuff and on from both of you, and then about the climate and all the links to what's going on. And I woke up around 4 a.m, having had this dream of, I don't know why I'm even sharing this, but I had this dream that I had, I had this sense of extreme anguish, right? And it was right in my solar plexus. I felt like, and I was sure, even as I'm waking up from the dream, I thought, oh, someone, I get it. My parent died. I don't mean magically. I mean, oh, I just probably just forgot that I'm in mourning, that a parent died or my child died or something. And I'm like waking up counting, no, they're okay. And my dad died a long time ago. My wife is here. My child's okay. What just happened to me? And I thought maybe, you know, first I thought it was ESP, that some friend had died. And then I thought, oh, maybe I'm mourning my theater career, that I left the theater to become a writer. I didn't know what. And, you know, and then I realized, oh, my gosh, this is I'm finally accepting the tragedy of what we've done, of the innocence lost of our civilization, the real cost of capitalism and colonialism and endless extraction and trying to deliver exponential growth to the market is the potential extinction of our own and many other species.
Yeah, I think that for me, as a fashion sort of professional and like educator and stuff, I also preceded this whole thing with a project with a friend of mine, Miles, called Body Politic, and I said I wanted to make the most radical clothes that I possibly could. And for that, they needed to like turn people into an urgent message. And they also needed to be not for sale. And it felt at the time like it was like super basic, because I was just going, we can't sell this. It can't be for sale. It has to be not about money. And then it became like a participatory project where people make their own stuff. And loads of things came out of that. Like, people can't handle being given something for free as much as like they can handle paying for it. And I think the fact that this work has been so sort of framed in such a different way to like anything else that's market related, for me, is super important. Like, the people who are being given some expenses by this organism are not claiming a salary. They're not living off it. They're not relying on it next month or the month after. We've got very short sort of length of time that people are guaranteed to have support to help with this, because it's important that it doesn't become something which is like self-protecting or self-sustaining as part of an economic system which doesn't know how to support work which is only there for the purpose of like virtue and not there to serve any part of the market. So it feels to me like this is also an interesting progression into something that refuses to be like bound up by the logic of money or markets. It's entirely about being human being and what you love and what you care about. And it's not about getting £5 a month or trying to make sure that it still exists in a year's time. Like, if it does its job, then that's cool, you know.
It's interesting, an interesting reversal there, because I mean, I critique a lot of things as that we do so much for its utility value, and we understand human beings in terms of their utility value, meaning how are they serving the market? But, you know, and the critique of this sort of work could be that, oh, well, it has no utility value. If you don't have a market for it, then it doesn't really exist. But really what you're saying is, no, actually, this is pure utility value. We're not serving that bizarre, symbolic, abstracted value of markets and money. And, you know, this is not helping the stock market, but it's has the pure utility value of species sustainability, you know?
Well, to be honest, Douglas, we actually move away from sort of utilitarian ethics and talk about virtue ethics, because this is not about calculating whether we're going to be successful or not. Obviously, we're trying to optimize that, and we're trying to look at what things we need to do that give us the best chances of success. But ultimately, I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do, and I feel really clear about that. And in a deeper part of myself, you know, when you describe that crisis you had in the middle of the night last night, I think there's something in our collective memory. Daniel Pinchbeck talks about trauma as a collective environmental trauma being the way that there'll be a consciousness shift in humanity. I think there's something in our consciousness, and it's held in the more traditional ways in the indigenous cultures, that knows that life isn't about me and you and Claire and anybody else. Life's about life. It's beyond us. It's bigger than us. We're the entirety of life. And we have our place in it, in this version of life. You know, here's me being a Gale version of life. And, you know, I'm quite annoying at times, actually. I'll be quite glad to see the back of me at some point. But there's other versions of life, you know. In the indigenous traditions, you honour the ancestors and acknowledge the past, and you honour the and protect the next seven generations. And I think that feeling, if you tap into it like it sounds like you did last night, it's not even the death of your children, because as sad as that is, we all know that's also going to happen. The reality is that our whole beings, there's an aspect of us that wants life to live. And when you can be in that space and you can really ask yourself, have we had enough of this civilization in its current form? I am sick of it, you know. Are you really sick of it? So what are you going to do about it? If you want life to live and for us to move into something else, because we have the imagination. I know this is your Team Human piece, right? We have this incredible imagination, this incredible ability to be something amazing in the universe, and we can be also just awful and terrible and do the worst things. Well, we want life to live, and I think there's that part of ourselves, when that's in the driving seat, we'll solve this.
And the first step to that seems to be to, I mean, for those who aren't that familiar with Extinction Rebellion, it seems the most visible first step is to sit on bridges, right? Which is what happened in, when was that?
That was in November. I wouldn't say that is the first step. The first step is to get some of the information and to digest it and to really let it go beyond your left brain, the information, and let it sink into your guts and have a dark night of the soul. I think that's the best first step, actually. You hear about people who, there've been lots of people who've already been there panicking and they're like, thank God somebody's acknowledged this. But I think, and I'm even talking about environmentalists, I'm talking about people who've had to, and blessings and honorings to people that have spent years fighting. But I would even say to many of the green movement is to have that pause to say where we really are here now, and to have that feeling. I'm not instructing anybody. I mean, I know many environmentalists would have deeply been through that process, but I can say for myself and other people that I know that we hadn't, and it's so important.
Right, but then you can't stay alone with it, or you turn into the Unabomber, or like a lot of my friends are. I mean, and it's, I'm happy they have civil defense supplies or they have water in their basement, but they also have shotguns. You know, they're thinking about, okay, this awful shit's going to happen. So how am I going to protect myself and my family from everybody else? Like the billionaires with their bomb shelters. That seems to be a lot of people's first reactions in an individualistic society, either that or despair. And you're suggesting that no. Now, which is what I'm arguing too, sort of find the others, that you can't do this alone.
Absolutely. And that's when you get on the bridges. And actually, it's a load of fucking fun, to be honest, hanging out. I keep describing it this way, and it may not be the same for everybody. I think it's really quite sexual. It's quite a sexual energy. It's that bit of you that goes, you know what? Fuck it. I'm not putting up with this anymore. And it's very cheeky. And it's very connected. And we had the most beautiful time in London. I mean, it's such days of our lives, such, you know, as Quakers say, live life adventurously. You know, what does love call us to do? And when you're living in that way, it's just awesome.
Never doubt that a small group of people can change the world indeed. It is the only thing that ever has.
Gets critiqued as well, though. They say, oh, look at them, they're having too much fun, or oh, look, Johnny went to the rebellion because there were pretty girls there. I mean, as if that's a bad reason to go. You know?
Well, they actually fueled the Serbian revolution on sex. I understand that you couldn't be part of the rebellion in Serbia without doing 10 graffitis of a fist symbol of the revolution, and so that, you know, you couldn't just be talking a good game, you had to get out there and do that. And then they had parties, you know, and I'm really happy to see XR youth taking off at the minute. I think they're gonna, you know, I think it's, I'm 47 soon, I think it's for our generation to have started this process, and we're like wading through treacle. But when the young ones, as they are with the school strikes, are rising up, you know, this, it'll be irresistible, it'll be unstoppable. But in the Serbian revolution, what happened, they had these parties, and then people would get arrested. They're like, hang about, you're arresting kids who are just having a party. And for every arrest you got a t-shirt. And when you had 10, you got a black t-shirt. And then you were super cool and everybody wanted to have sex with you, and it was fueled by sex, you know. So bring it on. Great.
Right. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a bonus.
Why does everything have to be so earnest? I can tell you, when I'm dealing with, you know, and I know Claire, we are working really, really hard. It's a horrendous number of emails and spreadsheets, and it's not fun, most of it. So if we get to have some days of pleasure in the middle of it, then so be it. You know, I keep saying I get arrested just because I need some time out. Mm. you get food brought to you in your cell, and you can sit there, yeah, reading books. It's like happy days, you know.
There's also a piece in, like, some of the research by which I guess Roger agrees with, and this wonderful person Danny Burns, who's written about the poll tax rebellion in the UK and has been involved in sort of action based movements for years and years, that like actions create like a sense of unity, and they help people to feel that they do something positive together. You go out, you have a good time, you feel like connected with all the people, and it helps you to feel like a stronger unit and a big sense of trust with the people that you go out and like reclaim some space or glue yourself to a building or whatever it is. And the sort of sense of togetherness that people have from that is actually really important, because I think the actions do something that counters the sort of hyper-individualized and therefore actually sort of like quite lonely and quite vulnerable place that a lot of people are in because of the way that our society seems to be at the moment. So for them to be like spaces that are either full of grief like a funeral or full of joy like we were on the bridges, or full of like contention like holding a people's assembly on the street and asking people to talk about quite difficult topics, like all of those things do help to like go against this sort of understood narrative, which I feel that I've grown up into, that you're basically on your own and you need to like save money and protect your own and buy a house and do all the things the right way and have a pension and all of this stuff. And actually going against all of that feels like quite important, and actions that feel fun and sexy and exciting and together, like they do sort of like tackle all of that just through one thing, you know, one event.
Well, they feel sexy and exciting to us. I mean, when I walked around London and talked with whatever you want to call them, regular people, about, well, how did you feel when the five bridges were blocked? They said, oh, motherfuckers, you know, blocking the bridges, getting in the way, it ruined my day, I couldn't get to work. And I remember back in the, you know, when we shut down the Golden Gate Bridge and the AIDS protests, 20 years ago, people didn't understand. Well, wait a minute. I get it. You're upset about AIDS. Why are you ruining my commute?
But so that is exactly the point, though, and that's in the literature now. ACT UP is one of the classic case studies of that's why you have to do that. So nobody was talking about AIDS research and how the gay community was getting treated in terms of medical care. And ACT UP made it impossible not to be having that conversation. So a classic thing in the literature is that people will say, well, you know, obviously I agree with them, but I don't like the way they're going about it. Well, the point is they're having the conversation. So it's not our job to get liked. It's our job to get people talking, to shift what's called the Overton window of what public dialogue is. So one of my favourite things from the autumn was one of our very right-wing politicians you might have heard of called Nigel Farage got caught up in one of the roadblocks, and apparently he said that we were economic terrorists and then started talking about extinction. Well, job done, you know. So right. although when we do the roadblocks, because we are super lovely about it, so we have these apologetic signs. So I'm talking about the swarming roadblocks now, but not the bridges actions. But you go on the road for 7 minutes, 7 minutes on and off, so you're creating a lot of disruption. You have these signs saying, we're really sorry, 7 minutes and we'll be gone. And then they go and give the car drivers a biscuit because, you know, we all love a biscuit, don't we? And I've been told that about 50% of car drivers say, well, yeah, it's a bit annoying, but actually I agree with you and I'm glad you're doing it. Thank you. So,
right. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I look at it from the model of immune response, you know, the immune response of the body. And it's like, at a certain point, the immune response does create inflammation, you know, and inflammation is part of the healing process. If you don't get inflamed, you don't sneeze it out. You don't poop it out. You know, you've got to respond. And that was, you know, that was part of the ACT UP. The logic of ACT UP was, you know, not only does the body fail to mount an immune response to the AIDS virus, but our society is failing to mount a response to the AIDS crisis. You know, and likewise, it feels in you know, Extinction Rebellion, yes, it's going to annoy some people, but that's sort of the inflammation required to then get some kind of organismic response.
Exactly, exactly. It's a good analogy.
Then next, on April 15th, which is after we broadcast this, so it's coming up, April 15th, the plan is to just shut down London until something until something's done?
Yeah, sort of. There's so the plans are like in development still. So there's a few things that may change, but essentially lots and lots of people are going to take to the streets and take up space and cause a huge disruption until people in government agree to speak meaningfully about doing something that might change the sort of suicidal course that we're on. And that will involve probably an escalation strategy, much like we've used in the past. So you start with something and then you say, please, can we have a meeting and we need to do this? And then when they don't reply or when they say no, then you say, okay, and then there's an escalation and people will do something different. There's lots and lots of people coming from all over the country, so you're a bit booking on coaches. There's people who've set off on a march already from like Cornwall and from other parts of the country. They're walking here and they set off, what, two weeks ago now? So there are some extremely determined people on their way here. And yeah, and we've all been working very hard to make sure that when they arrive, we get to go out and there'll be beauty on the streets as well as disruption.
And obviously that's the UK plan. This is an international rebellion. There's groups in 30 countries across the world. And so we'll see what other countries come up with as part of their actions.
And are any of them in the US? Two or three people, at least.
Oh, there's quite a few groups in the US. Yeah, yeah.
Because I know, you know, we have Sunrise here, who I don't know if they're working with you, but it's certainly a sympathetic effort.
Yeah, I think, I wouldn't want to speak on behalf of American colleagues, but we were talking to Paul Engler recently, who wrote the book, This Is an Uprising. And Sunrise, in my understanding, are using the same sort of momentum-driven organising. In fact, I think they're probably doing a lot better job of it than we've done, so we need to learn from them. And then obviously you've got the school strikes as well.
Right, but are we doing, is April 15th happening in the US too?
Yeah, in my understanding, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you saw that, you know, in New York when there was the big action at the ice rink a few weeks ago.
The New York group involves a really wonderful performance artist called Reverend Billy. I don't know if know about him. And that group I watched like very keenly on the live stream on Facebook from my kitchen whilst they did their first like outing. And they went out with beautiful music and marched around the streets. And then they went to, I think, the Rockefeller ice rink and laid down on the ice and made an extinction symbol on the ground, and somebody climbed on the gold statues and hung a big banner on it, and several people got arrested for that. So that was their first sort of peaceful law-breaking action. So New York meetings seem to be well underway, and then there's lots of other chapters, I think, in the United States all around the country.
Yeah, so I haven't got the figures to hand, but there's there's a significant number of groups in the US.
And then the other tricky part then, so you know, so we're dealing with, there's this sort of spiritual organismic origins of it. There's the emotional piece that we have to deal with, which then brings us to the organization piece, which is part of forging, you know, the solidarity and rapport and friendship that you need to make it through this is part of what then leads to the organization. And the organization then leads to ultimately specific demands of, I hate to call it, out of government and one another. So how did you arrive at the demands? And in the States, we're having real problems with this. You know, so we have, you know, AOC and the Green New Deal, and people are distorting it in the States as if the Green New Deal is asking that we, you know, or that we make hamburgers illegal. And so people, oh, well, I don't want to sign on to that. I like my cow. It gets distorted right away. But I mean, what's the easiest way to articulate the demands of Extinction Rebellion of Parliament right now?
Well, so I think on the one hand, they're really pretty clever and cute, because we demand, I don't really like that word somehow, because this is a collective longing, isn't it? But we're asking the government to tell the truth and to work with the media, to work alongside the media to communicate that truth to citizens and to reverse any policies that are inconsistent with the truth. That's the first one. The second one's about rapid reduction in carbon, decarbonisation to net zero by 2025. I mean, some of these things might get tweaked, by the way, but there's somebody looking at the demands at the minute, and a reduction in consumption consistent with, you know, removing the ecological overshoot where we use up more than the planet's worth of resources. The bit where I think it's cute is that we haven't said how this thing should be done, because what I think Extinction Rebellion's really about is democracy, and saying that democracy is not capable in its current form of being that truthful and actually sorting it out and coming up with the right policies. And that's why it hasn't been sorted out. You know, that's why there's still a massive subsidy to the fossil fuel industry and fracking starting across the world and incineration, all the rest of it. So the third demand is that we have, and it might be a slightly different format in other countries, but we have a citizens' assembly, which is when you choose of order 1,000 people by like a jury, sort of randomly selected people. A lot of experts come and with data and explain exactly what the situation is. And then many different experts with solutions come and present ideas, and that jury comes up with the final protocol for how this is solved. And what that's done with Extinction Rebellion is it's meant that we've not wasted huge amounts of time arguing over different solutions, because in all honesty, like Naomi Klein once said, you know, your demands can only be as big as your movement. And so it's kind of like a waste of energy. I mean, it's awesome that people have these debates, you know, they all need to happen about which is the best solution. How would you do a Green New Deal? What is reality? That to what extent do things have to be done, and so on? But what will happen is that you'll get distracted debating those solutions, whereas in reality, it needs to be led by the people. I think there is an issue in the demands, and this will just be a personal opinion, but it's a critique of Extinction Rebellion, and I do hope we're going to sort it out, which is that the kind of climate justice, and from my perspective also deep ecology, is not baked into them strongly enough. So the minute the Citizens Assembly, it's not, as I understand it, it's something that you leave to the people, but from my perspective, you've got to make sure the solution's just. I mean, there's a solution to climate change that involves land grabbing and killing loads of people, you know. I mean, that's one way of going about it, isn't it? The billionaires from their bunkers could release a few viruses that they've got the antidotes for. I mean, there's all sorts of solutions that are not cool, you know.
Yeah, it seems it's why, I mean, my understanding of why Trump and so many people are supporting a wall, you know, to block America from Mexico, is to stop the immigration of climate change refugees over the next two decades.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be, I mean, literally, it's already happening in Europe where we let people drown in the sea. I mean, the issue is that if you look at the map of where what happens with the Greenland ice sheet melting, which is melting more quickly than was ever expected, it doesn't, it's obviously not cool for the people that have done the least damage to the climate to be the ones suffering the most. And it's also the case that you're going to have migration within the United States anyway, because so many of your cities and our cities in the UK are on rivers, are on the coast, and they're going to go under. So where are all those people going to go? You know, so you
right.
can build
well, the
walls,
ones in the middle are going under too. I mean, where our producers up in Omaha, Nebraska, which is inland and buried and submerged.
Yeah. And then the you'll get areas of drought, and also all these other places that our racism allows us to decide that we can just ignore. Certainly in the UK, it's places where we get a lot of our food from. So you look at a map and think, oh, well, you know, the water problem's not in my country. Well, actually, by the way, that's where you get your dinner from, you know.
Right. Well, that whole one white Western European or American life is worth, you know, 16, you know, brown ones of sub-Saharan Africa. And it's like, it's like, excuse me, you know, that and media helps perpetuate this dehumanization of our, you know, of our brothers and sisters in other places, as if, you know, being in another country means they're not part of you.
And I think there's, yeah, exactly. But I think there's also something really profound here that needs to shift. And I'm glad you use that brothers and sisters piece, because we're a family, and the trees are our grandparents, and okay, this is a pagan of me speaking, but you know, the animals are our cousins, and there's a deep interconnectedness that ecological science would 100% back up here. We live in a system that's based on the idea of scarcity, that there's not enough, and so therefore I've got to be in competition, when the reality of nature is that everything is food for something else. It's an utterly miraculously abundant system, if only you will, you know, tune into that. And that doesn't mean becoming primitive. That means, you know, using the new technologies of biomimicry and so on.
Right. I mean, this is so key to the fight that I've been having, which is, you know, I've been arguing that the digital retrieves the medieval, you know, at its best. We're retrieving, I mean, because when I hear what you're talking about, a lot of it comes from alchemical, magical, Francis Bacon style scientific rape, if you will, you know, and it's both ancient in that sense, and that you're retrieving your myth of the eternal return, you're retrieving pre-modern understandings of science and energy and connectedness, at the same time that you're informed by, I mean, as a PhD molecular biologist, you're informed by systems theory, you know, which, you know, I guess Bucky Fuller and Norbert Wiener and Bates and folks kind of brought back for us, but we're only coming to understand, you know, our place in reality and the environment as a combination of these very modern digital age understandings of systems and interrelatedness, and these sort of more ancient understandings of chaos that we're maybe finally courageous enough to retrieve, not to return to, but to retrieve and be informed by.
It's what Charles Eisenstein calls the new old story. Mm. So it's an ancient story, but there's going to be a new version of it, isn't there? It's a reunion. But this idea that we're all separate from each other and all powerless is completely incorrect. And we're getting that story back, but, you know, backed up by lots of different science, backed up by art and culture in its best formats.
But that's why, I mean, it's why it's a molecular biologist and a fashion activist join up, you know, and because what you're doing is not just calculated climate activism, but this kind of retrieval of, I mean, I hear the words you use, retrieval of love, retrieval of emotion, a retrieval of paganism, of poetry, of magic, you know, in order to fight what are essentially demons at this point.
I mean, I think another way of looking at it, Douglas, and I'm sure you've covered that in previous research and so on, is that is a sort of teal consciousness, isn't it? It's this sort of idea from spiral dynamics that you can look back at all the different consciousnesses that we bring. You know, I mean, see me when I'm hangry, as they say, you know, that's a version of consciousness, isn't it? It's like, well, on the day of my moon cycle when I want to kill everybody. I mean, this is we all have different versions of ourselves running, but there's a version of consciousness that's coming online now, and that's kind of to look at all these consciousnesses and see the value in them and what they bring and where the limitations are, and to integrate them and to bring the new way forwards.
And that's even, is that even the forms of consciousness that people we don't like have?
Well, we have to stop not liking them. We've got quite a sort of funny tension, if you like, in XR, but I think it's creative. I don't think it's a problem where my colleague Roger will be like, "Ah, the elites, and I'm kind of going, we are, you know, I didn't invent this phrase, but, you know, we are the 100%. We are really all in this one together. And of course, there's some awful behavior by some people that needs sorting out. But, you know, when people get into that kind of, you know, tribal conservatism, there's a part of me that totally is behind the idea that your family comes, you know, your immediate family is, that's where your responsibilities most immediately lie, and that you want people to have personal responsibility. I can see the my son's in a football team, put me in that front of that team and I want them to win, you know? I mean, there is that energy in them. I just don't need to go and punch anybody in the face about it, you know? So, yeah.
Right, but there's a way to leverage that too. I mean, so in America, if we see, well, look, you know, Donald Trump shows up in a town and 20 or 30,000 people are willing to, gather into a stadium, you know, to cheer and to be together. There's something's being fed that needs to be fed there too. And there's an energy and a frustration that's expressing itself that could be used for the benefit of all of us as well.
Well, I think you have to look at, and it's, you know, outside of my psychological knowledge. I mean, I think George Lakoff's a good author in this case, but how things get framed and which emotions get tapped into. I think it's a little harder probably to tap into the emotion of love over the emotion of hate, but it's so much more powerful when you're in there. You know, you look at any stories about wars and you can get people to do really, really terrible things, but there's a place when people come out of that madness and go, my God, what did we do? You know.
But in order to do that, though, I mean, the thing I experienced the other night and I'm still wrestling with today, I mean, I'm not saying I'm a Superman, but I don't know how many people would want to deal with that or to push through that or could quite face that or wouldn't just take an OxyContin or a Prozac to not feel it. You know, this is pretty hard. It's a pretty difficult place we're bringing people to. I mean, maybe kids could do it more easily, you know. They just walk, you know?
I think for me, like, there's something here about empathy, and there's something else about, like, the situation that we've put ourselves in, where if you really confront it, you feel like you've got nothing to lose because we are about to lose everything. And that's the confrontation, which is very liberating for quite a lot of people who feel like constantly contorted and compromised and in pain because they're trying really hard to be part of a system that's like making us all sick, that's making us all unhappy. That, you know, that you understand that if you win off it, you win off the back of a lot of other people's suffering. Like, there's nobody who's part of sort of capitalist Western civilization, I think, that doesn't really sort of like know that deep down. And a friend of mine said something when the financial crash happened. I had a mate who's really like not political at all, and she just came out with this thing. She was like, Joe, I don't give a shit about this crash because, like, I've got nothing to lose. So it's like, what do they want? I've got nothing, so they can't fucking touch me, right? So it doesn't matter. I really don't care. I don't care about the economy, and I don't care about rich people. I don't care about anything. And I was like, it's really funny because there's some sense of, like, when you go through those dark nights and you think, right, we're so close to not being able to fix this anyway, we're so close to the edge. And that's what kind of I felt like I'd gone through, thinking, well, I'm totally disenfranchised with green capitalism. It's a load of shit. And like, we've lost, and I don't really know what to do with the rest of my life. Like, if you feel like you've got nothing to lose, then you're able to like act in new ways. And that's, in a way, like, I feel like the people who reach for that rhetoric of like build a wall or find solidarity with people who are going to pick up their guns and like protect some little thing that they've got and blame scapegoat groups of people, like they're really doing it out of a place of trying to protect something that they feel they're going to lose, in a way. That feels to me quite strong. And my project that I was saying about turning the body into a message, we worked on this long, long document together, putting ideas into it about what we thought we wanted to wear. And we felt like everybody needed an injection of like positivity and resistance and not just anti stuff. And we, all the words that came to the top that we felt the most, that resonated the most and felt the most urgent, were words like empathy and humility, frugality, compassion. And we, neither of us practice religious anything, and we were quite struck by the fact that these were precisely the things that we wanted to like emblazon our clothes with and walk around trying to start conversations about. So for me, it speaks to that, it's a longing, like Gail said, I think, for these sort of things to be able to be given space and be given like energy to, rather than being sort of constantly squashed and pushed to the side.
But at the same time, when you push through to the other side of that despair, you pulled your art, you know, out of that some organization that was getting money from arms dealers, right? So that personal sacrifice. So here you have art that's going to get seen and written about. No, oh, pull that out. You go get arrested, I think, at Heathrow. You did a Gandhi-like two-week hunger strike, which are these acts of from my perspective as, you know, a coddled little American who you don't want to see me if I don't get my coffee and my morning muffin. it seems like this act of extreme, I mean, it's not just a theme. These are acts of extreme courage, of fortitude. So, I mean, not just to praise you for doing these things, but the place from which you're able to draw the strength to do that is on the other side of that chasm. It's like you push through the despair, and then is there this some kind of an energy that comes that allows you to do these Gandhi-like feats of resistance?
I've got nothing better to do.
That's a great answer. There's a myth in that's well known as an archetype, isn't there, about the hero's journey and each individual having their journey to be their better self. It is, and I think Claire used that word before, it's a liberation. It's a deep joy. I'm having the time of my life, you know. I really am. I went into a ceremony this weekend and I went really through the mangle, but I really am in a kind of so be it, you know, bring it on. It's quite an epic feeling in a way. It's not the only one. I mean, you know, I like a cup of coffee as well, Douglas. Yeah. we're all cuddled. I think the other thing people have to understand is that there's not a choice here, really. I mean, you're not going to get off this one lightly. I either we sort this out or the economy is going to collapse. You know, it's been good from our perspective that Sir David Attenborough, who's like a real national treasure in the UK, is on record as saying that the civilization could collapse, you know, it's likely to collapse. So when civilizations collapse, it's not pretty. People are on streets, you get cannibalism, you get food shortages, you get riot, you know, it's not cool. You're unlikely to be able to protect yourself in that kind of culture. So in David Wallace Wells' book, he quotes some research that for every 1 degree of warming, the economic growth will go down by 1%. So it's finished. We have to go, it's over, this civilization. And as some people have said, we're up to our neck in canaries in the coal mine, you know, whether it's the 74% of insect death or the 80% of earthworms that are gone or the little birds that have gone down by 70, you know, it's around us and we're on that list. The warming that's happening is worse than the Permian mass extinction. You might want to cling on to your bit of comfort for now, but actually the deal is wake up, because if we sort it out now, it's going to be amazing. It's going to still be painful. It's still going to be a mess. We're in a catastrophe. We're not going to get rid of it, but it's going to be a damn sight better doing this in a connected way than waiting for some kind of hideous version of eco-fascism to take over and decide that all our children have to go to war to fight over water. I mean, I'm not having it. You know, if you're a parent especially, come on, folks, wake up. Political theory from people like Hannah Arendt says that the power lies in the collective. And that's the bit that we've got to get with. It's when we're together. And you have these days on the bridges and you look in each other's eyes. When we took over Parliament, a friend of mine was singing this beautiful song about, if you want to know where the power lies, take a look into each other's eyes. And you have these moments of feeling that when we really know that as a human species, that we're a collective and that we believe in each other and we believe in ourselves.
Right. I mean, I feel like part of the beauty of the protests, you know, when I was watching the videos of it, first I was concerned that it's happening on all these separate bridges. So how are they all part of the same thing? But then I saw that, oh, this is more beautiful even, that there's these, each one is its own party. You don't need to even be part of some central one. It's not Bruce Springsteen at the, you know, in the middle main one. It's like, no, we're each having our own one. And it sort of set up the idea that, oh, we could sit on the bridge in my own little town, you know what I mean? And have our own 30 people sit there. So when you start talking about economic solutions, I feel like one trap I see people getting into is like, oh, we've got to change the global economy somehow by all joining together. And the global economy, this scaled notion of economics, is itself part of the problem. And I'm so much more in favor of, okay, how could this community create a favor bank or its own currency or its own connection with the local agriculture, so that if I were going to have a pull the plug moment, it would be, when are you willing to pull the plug from your connection to the global economy and take care of 80 or 90% of your economic needs locally? And what would that look like?
Brilliant. Yeah, totally. It's circles of circles of circles, isn't it? It starts very local, and that's where most of it needs to happen.
Thanks so much, first, for what you're doing. I mean, I guess if people are interested in obviously, if they're in the UK, go outside on April 15th and you'll see what's happening. And in the States, I guess people should go, find the websites for, and we'll link to it, but for Reverend Billy, for Sunrise, for, and Extinction Rebellion, I'm sure has links to the global, many of the global local possibilities.
It's the website is rebellion.earth. And by the way, the UK is quite a lot bigger than London.
Yeah.
So if you go outside in Milton Keynes or Hemel Hempstead or South Hemsall in West Yorkshire, you might not see people blocking bridges. You need to get down to London. We do have a few countries in the UK like Scotland and Wales as well, but the invitation is mostly focused on London. But yeah, there's all the information people need is on rebellion.earth.
And one thing I didn't ask you about was you're connected with Greta, the young woman from Sweden who's been so articulate on much of what's happening. Are you friends with her? Was she at your bridge events, or
she came to our launch event and helped us to launch the Extinction Rebellion? Yeah, she's awesome. I'm a massive fan.
So we can't save the world by playing by the rules, because the rules have to be changed. Everything needs to change, and it has to start today. So everyone out there, it is now time for civil disobedience. It's time to rebel.
Yeah, and and she always ends her speeches with, and well, you're not going to do anything. You're going to listen and clap and then go on with what you're doing. I know it. So it's going to be up to me and my friends to make a difference. It's inspiring, yet it's also somehow disempowering. I feel like, no, I want to prove you wrong.
I mean, good for her for winding up the adults. When she sat outside the Swedish parliament, she's got some leaflets that say in Swedish, the adults are shitting on our future. I mean, she doesn't pull her punches, does she? I think she needs to call out the grown-ups and the parents that are having... We have our heads in the sand. We've had our heads in the sand. We've been pretending that we're doing something about this. And it's fair enough to get called on it.
And also that response in Davos, when she spoke and she just sort of made a really good point, which was basically quite accusatory of the people in the room. And they gave her a round of applause. And I just thought, how rude to sit there and go, oh, well done, little girl. You've worked us out. Nice one. But like, you're still a little girl. So we'll just give you a round of applause and go, oh, that's sweet. Do you know what I mean? And I think what she's trying to say is like, don't patronize me. Like, we're going to build a movement and there's more of us than there is of you. And I've got faith. And like, we're just going to come and do it. So... either deal with it or don't, but it won't change the course of history.
Right, get on board or get out of the way. But this is happening. Oh, this is great. Well, I wanna let you go back to fighting against our extinction. But and most importantly, the most common email I get, and this one I probably get over 100 a day, are from people saying, "Oh, I listen to Team Human. I love it. How do I join Team Human? Where do I go?" And I've resisted forming a Team Human movement because it's not something, I don't want it to become a solipsistic thing that people are doing it to do it. It's not, this is a podcast or a book or I'm a person, I'm not a movement. But if you do want to join Team Human, join the Extinction Rebellion.
Yay.
Join Sunrise. That this is it. You know, so anyone who asks me, anyone who's listening and has sent that email, this is it. This is the thing you join. And not only is this an available opportunity, this is an all-hands-on-deck moment, right? This is it. You can rise to the occasion of your humanity or not, you know, and you'll get maybe another couple of opportunities, but this could be the last one. This could be your moment, the moment where you choose and where we as a species choose to keep on going, you know, not to accept our imminent demise and to, I mean, gosh, not just for the children, but for life itself. Life is a cool thing to have happened, whether it spontaneously emerged or whether it's the expression of a pre-existing consciousness. But it's something that really can, this instance of it is fragile and requires our participation at this point. And these women are offering one terrific gateway to that participation. So, you know, thank you for doing that. Thank you so much for being on Team Human and for trying to make it so Team Human gets to live another day.
You're really welcome. And being really practical, it'd be great if you had an automatic reply to your email with our website in and Sunrise and all of that, wouldn't it?
I think, well, that's what I'm going to do. I'll make a...
Here's some Team Human opportunities.
Exactly. Thanks for joining Team Human. Our guests today were Extinction Rebellion founders Gail Bradbrook and Claire Farrell. You can find out more about Extinction Rebellion at rebellion.earth or find the links at teamhuman.fm. If you're in the U.S., you may want to check out sunrisemovement.org, a similarly organized movement to promote the Green New Deal. We'll be back in the Basement Media Squad at the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at CUNY Queens next week with new strategies for intervention in the machine. You're on Team Human, our last, best hope for peace.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.